Normally, when students want to come and study a PhD with a professor, they do so because they largely agree with them and are interested in their work. Dr. Kyle Barrowman, however, went out of his way to travel across the ocean to come and do a PhD with me in Cardiff on the American action film and the American martial arts film and Bruce Lee. And he did so largely because he kind of disagreed with me. Kyle, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
So, you've read every word that I've ever written about Bruce Lee, and you came to Cardiff, and it seemed largely to disagree with me. Would that be a fair representation of the situation?
Yes, yeah, and I think it's the best kind of disagreement, because it's not just when you read someone and then you just throw the book across the room. It's you read it and you go, I have to talk to this person. I have to deal with this. I have to think about this. The first time I ever wrote anything as a scholarly person was about Bruce Lee, because that's obviously going to be the first thing I was going to write about. Yeah. And then that's when I found Theorizing Bruce Lee. And I was like, all right, anytime I think about Bruce Lee, I think this guy's probably written about it before, and I got to think through his stuff first.
So you are currently, let me just share a screen. Not that one. Let's share this one. So you are currently a lecturer, an adjunct faculty lecturer in DePaul in Illinois, Chicago area.
Yep.
And what are you teaching at the moment? Film and media?
Yeah, at the moment, technically media and cinema studies. So specialize in film. So teach different film history, film criticism classes, but I also teach media and cultural studies courses and teach at a couple different institutions in Chicago.
Okay. And we published some things together, didn't we? We published a guest edited issue of the journal Global Media in China. And we've done Bruce Lee's Media Legacies.
Yes.
Came out recently. We co-edited an issue of the journal Martial Arts Studies. We called that Bruce Lee's Martial Legacies. And today we decided we would talk about, well, everything and anything Bruce Lee. So what got you into Bruce Lee? What was it about Bruce Lee for you?
Well, it's hard for the what got me into it. I think the better question is what made me want to stay with it, because I've always said, I have a nice little slogan that for as long as I've had the ability to form memories, I can't remember not being obsessed with Bruce Lee. I just kind of came out of the womb like that. You can trace that back to my dad, because he enjoyed Bruce Lee when he was a teenager, and I just kind of came out and was introduced to it. But I just was always interested in movies and martial arts separately. So then martial arts movies was just obviously going to be something that I was interested in. And Bruce Lee was just always at the top of that list for any different criterion that you can think of. He was just the most interesting. He was the coolest looking fighter. The movies were the most interesting to me. Just any reason that I would be interested in movies or martial arts, he combined them both, and he was the best of both worlds for me.
So you're a pretty much an encyclopedic specialist in the American action film tradition. Is that a fair representation of your interests?
Yeah, I think generally, if you're talking about like the film studies background, if you're talking about from a scholarly perspective, what I specialize in, it is definitely American cinema generally. I enjoy classical Hollywood cinema. I can like teach classes on things like that. But the movies that I enjoy the most are definitely the action movies. And whether that includes martial arts or not, I prefer the martial arts. But if it's an American action movie, I've probably seen it at least once, and I've probably seen it more than once.
And I always found it quite interesting for someone as obsessed with film as you seem to be. You have fairly sharp cliff faces, isn't there? You go, have you seen this film? Yeah, I know everything about this film. I know everything about the making of it. I know everything. And I go, but have you seen this film? You go, no, I don't look at films like that. I don't watch any film that's like that. And it's just, there's a circle that it's all yours. And just outside of that, like even a step outside of it, like, I'm not watching it.
Yeah, I'll have, as I've grown just as a film viewer and then combining it with film scholar and educator, I've just found that this is going to be my world, And now if I'm going to talk about it, I need to know everything about it. That's a part of my obsessive personality. And then I can also separate things from like a scholarly perspective, like, okay, here's a nice group of things. I need to learn about it. I need to be able to talk about it. I can educate people on it. I can tell them why it's important, but it's not for me. This isn't mine. I don't really care about this. And then there's that group of films where I'm 30. I've reached a point. I was like, life is short. I'm not watching that. Other people can watch that. That can be their thing. Maybe I'll read an article if it's interesting, but I can't watch everything. And I'm not watching that.
But because there's too many more important things to be watching.
Yeah, and that's the terrible experience of life, that there isn't enough time. And every time I go to sleep, I was like, there's one more movie I could watch. There's one more thing that I could do. And it's like, not that one, this one.
But you also have an interest in would it be the Hong Kong action film, or would you, that's a kind of side or a sub specialism that you obsess over?
Yeah, and that, again, as with most things, that traces back to Bruce Lee. So as a kid growing up in America, you're going to see American movies. So I'm growing up and I'm seeing on TV, I'm seeing Hollywood products. But I also have Bruce Lee movies. So as you start to grow up, I'm like, okay, so these movies are very different from those movies, but this guy was working over here. What other stuff was going on here? And then that's where you get introduced to the actual Hong Kong martial arts cinema tradition, which is very different than the American tradition, but which is also very fascinating to me. So just as easily as I can watch a Steven Seagal movie, I can also enjoy King Hu and Cheng Chen and films like that. So if it's kind of fighting and action, I'm gonna watch it.
Yeah. And you, I mean, you have a very strong film studies, disciplinary film studies interest in Bruce Lee. So for me, Bruce, when the first kind of book of martial arts that I wrote, as you know, was Theorizing Bruce Lee. And for me, it wasn't about film studies as such. The subtitle was Film, Fantasy, Fighting, Philosophy. And that was each of the four chapters. So chapter was about Bruce Lee film, ostensibly. And then the place of Bruce Lee in kind of cultural fantasies about what we could be. So the way Bruce Lee kind of changed identities and activities in popular culture. And then fighting, I wrote about his about Jeet Kune Do and Wing Chun and debates in about his contribution to martial arts. And then philosophy and the question of whether there was any philosophy there, I suppose, would be the way of posing that. So for me, Bruce Lee was a way of working out how I could start to write about the importance of martial arts and media in culture. But for you, it was different, wasn't it? For you, I mean, your interest is in, I mean, well, how would you characterize your investment in this?
From the scholarly perspective, yes, film studies is definitely my disciplinary background. And that's always been kind of how I've thought of myself, even when we start to talk about the domain of martial arts studies. Always kind of thought of myself as like a film studies specialist. I can contribute the things in film studies that then can be combined with people who do like what you do. So in a sense, I always enjoy the fact that you've written a lot about Bruce from those perspectives, because then I don't have to. This is what I can refer to and then talk about some film-related things. So for me, from the film studies perspective, if you talk about sort of a methodological angle, I always come at things from the author-based perspective. So I enjoy the author-based criticism. So for me, I'm interested in, here is this piece of art. Now, what did this filmmaker want to convey? What were they trying to say? Why did they make this film like this? Why like this, not like that? Mm-hmm. So whatever film it is, I'm usually going to start there. The author model is just the nice heuristic. And in the case of Bruce Lee, that's always the interesting thing to me. So here you have this martial arts cinema tradition. Now in you slot this guy. And now these movies are starting to seem different. What is this guy's appeal? What's this guy's star persona? And then when he gets to make his own movies, how come now these are even different from both? What was going on with this guy? Why was he producing films like this? So that's kind of the perspective that I approach them from. And that would be sort of the film studies informed way that I like to approach those.
Okay. And the other thing that I know you are equally preoccupied with is the UFC, or is it MMA, or is it the UFC specifically? Which, how would you?
I MMA broadly. In terms of the history of MMA, my favorite things and the things that I'm the most knowledgeable about would be PANCRACE, which was the Japanese organization that technically predates the UFC, then the UFC, and then Pride Fighting Championships, the famous Japanese organization that the UFC then purchased when they got canceled. But the UFC is the touchstone. It's the premier MMA organization. So if you say MMA, that means UFC. So it's kind of UFC plus. I do enjoy MMA history and that vast landscape.
Hmm. So when you're not watching films, you're on the Sherdog
forum. Yes. Yeah, I've been on that forum since I was in high school. I've been moderating that forum since I was in college. Yeah, that's MMA has always been the big thing, and I usually like to say that I can actually use that phrase. I've forgotten more about this than you'll ever know. I can actually use that phrase about movies and MMA. Just an encyclopedia, and those are the things that I enjoy the most.
Yeah, I can use that about most things, but that's just because I'm very forgetful. Do you argue? You argued recently at a conference in California last year about you were talking about the invention of the notion of MMA. And your argument was that really, if we're going to be pedantic about it, if we're going to be precise and technical, there was no MMA before the UFC because it was in the media, the commentator discourse of the UFC, that the term mixed martial arts was first used publicly anyway, and it's from there that it grew. So therefore, logically, the UFC invented MMA. Now, that's an argument that people are going to misunderstand, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there's the difference between here is this history, here's this legacy of a certain type of competition, of a certain type of way of organizing a combat sport. You have the legacy that goes back to the Vale Tudo days in Brazil. You have a lot of stuff that you can kind of plot on the timeline and say, well, this goes into that. This kind of comes from that. You can do that, and that's very historically interesting and accurate. But because I am very logical and precise and pedantic, and I enjoy the little nitpicky things, The concept of MMA, the term mixed martial arts, what that means and how that kind of organizes people's understandings and practices, that did not exist prior to 1993, number one, and that's when the UFC was invented. But even there, you can't say that, yeah, MMA started in 1993. It didn't. It still took a couple of years for them to go from no holds barred fighting and NHB, which was a three-letter acronym that was actually used to define what this thing was for a few years. It wasn't until they started to get the political pressures, they started to worry about getting taken off of pay-per-view, they started to worry about that government encroachment. They're like, all right, we got an image problem and we have a conception problem. We can't think of this as no holds barred, one man, two men enter, one man leaves. This isn't going to work. And this isn't really what this thing is, and it's certainly not what we want it to be. So they needed to kind of hit pause and say, let's reset, let's think about this thing anew. How can we do this in a productive way? And that's when they hit on, and by they, it's particularly Jeff Blatnick, the Olympic gold medalist and big figure in the wrestling world, and Big John McCarthy, the famous UFC referee. It was really the two of them kind of brainstorming things, and they're the ones who hit on and really liked the idea, let's call it mixed martial arts. And now from this point on, they have a nice little broadcasting powwow. From this point on, when you're on camera, you don't call it NHB, you don't call it anything, you say mixed martial arts. And then UFC 9 in 1996, was the first broadcast where they actually said that word. And from then on, that's the concept that kind of organized that particular organization. And then it just exploded from there. Like, yeah, this is what we do. This is called mixed martial arts. And then from there, we get the contemporary history that we do know for the last 15 years.
So it was a deliberate or a strategic rebranding because of the dignity that the term martial arts could confer upon this practice, because you can, so these aren't just thugs, these aren't just animals, these are martial artists who are testing their mettle against each other, and in the process they've cross-trained, so they're multidisciplinary experts. So you're raising this from the idea of a barroom brawl to something exquisite, potentially.
Yeah, and that's the thing too that's fun when you do, like when I did this type of investigation, just an excuse to marathon Fight Pass UFC event, but you can see that as soon as it started, when you're listening to the commentators, it's not like it was confusing to them and it took them 9 broadcasts for them to understand what was happening. They were talking through it. They know that when Ken Shamrock and Royce Gracie stepped into the cage at UFC 1, and they don't even really know what jiu-jitsu is. They're like, okay, these are two guys who like to be on the ground. I wonder if that's going to cancel out, and it's going to be a question of striking. They're already thinking through these things about cross-training, about what is it going to look like when these people enter a cage, and there are mixed martial arts here. Yeah. Like, the idea was there, but the ability to kind of combine what was happening, different ways to think about it, was absolutely, I like the term, it's rebranding. We have a brand issue, and that kind of helped bring together all the disparate elements of what was happening in the cage versus now how do we think about it and talk about it outside of it.
Yeah, I watched, I recently rewatched the first, maybe the first four UFCs.
It's so much fun.
It's really interesting to plot the language used and the concept used. So in the first one, there's some confusion about what Hoist Gracie is up to. There's not entire confusion, but there's some people going, oh no, he's a ground fighter, he's going to take it to the ground, and he's going to choke him out, and that's going to be that. And then in UFC 2, it's very clear, they're going to say, and now he's going to do this. And then he's actually saying, first he'll do this, then he'll do this, then he'll do that, and it's gone. And that's exactly what Hoist Gracie did. But the fighters in the ring didn't know that. Still, by UFC 3, you've got people who, they don't know how to put on a guillotine, they don't know how to, what they can't find a choke. They just, and it's, and they, and the commentators are going, why does he not know what to do? It's really interesting, isn't it? Like that, intellectually, the people who've looked at it from the outside have gone, ah, ground fighting, okay. But the competitors themselves, some of them just go, no, I've always hit people. Hitting is what I'm going to continue doing.
Yeah, and that's something that, I mean, that was the kind of, you want to say the battle that was waged, but that was something that the Gracies, that's what they did all through the 20th century, just trying to break through. Like, there's also this thing. There's this thing on the ground. It's like, I'm not saying the punching and kicking isn't good, but what happens if this happens? Mm. What are you going to do if you end up on your back and some dude's sitting on your chest? Mm. Doesn't matter how hard you punch or kick here. But I like, too, in the early UFCs, UFC 1 is just fascinating. It's so interesting watching that. You have Bill Superfoot Wallace on the broadcast. No one should have ever put a microphone in front of that guy's face. He had a tough night on the mic. Mm-hmm. Kathy Long, the female kickboxing champion, and Jim Brown, the NFL Hall of Famer. Like, who the hell put this panel together? Yeah. And nobody knows what they're looking at. Yeah. And then at UFC 2, they're like, okay, who in this area does Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu? And you get that guy, Ben Perry, who is a film stunt guy, which is an interesting action. And then he's the one who's sitting there like, okay, well, now he's going to pass, clear his legs, and you get to the mount. And then when he does mount, he's going to roll over, and he's going to get his back. He's like, did you choreograph this? It's like, well, no, I know what that thing is. That's called Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Are other people not paying attention? But there are people who are going to step in the cage and be like, I have done Kenpo karate for 30 years. I can handle anything. No, you can't. And those broadcasters, it's very interesting, like you were saying, when you plot it and you see the language, very quickly, that idea of cross-training and multiple disciplines, that's coming up. And they're like, all right, this is going to be a thing. This is going to be something. And then here, let's talk about it. And then you do wonder, how long is it going to take for that, whatever you call it, paradigm shift, or how as long is it going to take for people to realize this? And I usually pin it to UFC 5 just because it's convenient. But when you follow Ken Shamrock, he walks into UFC 1, sees a little guy in a gi, just assumes, all right, what, karate? He's going to try to kick me? Okay, I'm going to just grab his leg. And then he gets choked out. He's like, all right, what the hell was that? Yeah. Then UFC 5, that dude who had the what the hell was that reaction, now is able to completely shut down Hoist and kind of shut down the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu game because he trained it and he learned it and had it become part of his arsenal. So it's a nice, quick little arc that you can pin to one person and see, well, here's stage one of evolution. Learn it and bring it in. Hmm.
So, I mean, there's a number of different things that we could talk about from here. I mean, what do we see in terms of like the cinematic legacy of the UFC? I mean, how long does it take before film fight choreography registers MMA?
Well, I can't do long story short version, so this will be a long one. It's a big surprise. I'm just warning the viewers who don't know me. So it's interesting that again, with the film stunt thing, it's always a fascinating crossover. You think of real martial arts, and then you think of fake movie martial arts. And then it's always interesting to look at stunt performers and martial arts stars, how they kind of straddle that line in between those two worlds. Mm-hmm. And that's usually going to be the way that new stuff enters the cinematic world. It's going to be through them, through fight choreographers, mm-hmm. through stunt coordinators, and through top performers. And before he was able to have the success that he had creating the UFC, Horion Gracie, one of the sons of Elio Gracie, older brother to Hoist Gracie, and sort of the brains behind the UFC, he actually came to California, had a gym, was doing the whole Gracie Challenge thing in the US, having people come to his garage and do challenge matches, create different little groups for different students, and he was working in Hollywood. And he was the fight coordinator for the 1987 film Lethal Weapon, where Mel Gibson beats Gary Busey with a triangle choke. Mm-hmm. So that's there. But it doesn't become a big thing. It doesn't become a mainstay. It doesn't become part of the regular repertoire of stunt choreography and different cinematic options, really, until after 2005. And that's when The Ultimate Fighter premiered on Spike TV. And you got that initial mainstream boom of MMA. So MMA came out in 1993. It was a big sensation on pay-per-view. People were talking about it for a few years. And then that novelty, fad, underground, dark, against the rules kind of thing bit them in the ass, excuse the language. And you had some pay-per-view problems. And then that went into the dark ages. So it was a niche thing for many, 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 many years. It survived by the internet and the hardcore people who just liked watching it. It wasn't until the mid-2000s that it became a big thing, a popular thing, a mainstream thing. They had a reality show. They were on free TV. They were on pay-per-view. Chuck Liddell has a mohawk. Let's watch this guy. And it becomes really popular, and it enters that popular consciousness. Hmm. So in the mid-2000s, that's really when this stuff starts. So I think it was 2007 that the not that good, but not as bad as people think movie Never Back Down came out. And that was kind of the biggest MMA movie at the time. It has teenage characters, it's about high school. So like my cousin, like, hey, have you ever seen Never Back Down? I was like, why do you know what that is? Mm-hmm. It's like, that's how big this is that you're asking me about this. And that's when you start to see MMA in movies, when you start to see, hey, that guy just put up a triangle. Now that guy powerbombed him, just like Rampage powerbombed Ricardo Arona. And now that becomes the thing you do if you're going to choreograph a movie fight scene. So it's really the mid-2000s that this starts to catch on. It's like, okay, this is kind of the cool new thing. This is going to be part of our martial arts choreography.
Okay, so Bruce Lee, I mean, his impact on... So we all know there were other martial traditions, there are other choreographic traditions, and we know they were happening in the 60s. But in terms of the impact of Jun Fan Kung Fu, and...
Yeah, I got a stretch, and I also got so a in not terms subtly of, show the shirt.
Yeah, in terms... So Bruce Lee's impact when Enter the Dragon came out was enormous and instant. And instantly people tried to emulate. So this is when you got the production of more and more and more Western-made martial arts films. And there's been different iterations of this, different versions of these films. But how long do you think it took before we saw something that wasn't simply a reaction or an attempt to be as good as Bruce Lee choreography? How long did it take Hollywood in particular to produce something that could be said to be, you know, that you can see Bruce Lee there, you can see the influence of Bruce Lee in that, other than high kicks and you know, jumps and throws?
It's hard to say. There are different ways to answer that question in terms of, like, when did it exist? And then when did it exist well? And yeah. Then when was it kind of reoccurring and regular? Yeah. Bruce Lee is definitely a very interesting figure, and you definitely see that immediate explosion. And when you, if you want to convey the immediacy, then you have to talk about blaxploitation, which is nobody's idea of high cinema and quality cinema, but you have to mention it. And when you get Jim Kelly, who's co-starring with Bruce in Enter the Dragon, I think it's literally a year later, I think it was 1974, he was in Black Belt Jones. He started doing the martial arts stuff. So that's there immediately, it is. But if you're talking about quality, I think it takes a while. And no disrespect to Chuck Norris, but I think it takes even longer than him. I wouldn't say martial arts cinema quality was his strong suit when he came out on the scene in the 70s. I think it really took until the 80s for Hollywood to have a venerable American martial arts cinema tradition. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Steven Seagal is a little bit off the beaten path because he's unique with the Aikido and the grappling. That's not really the striking paradigm that you get with Bruce Lee. So I'm not the biggest fan of his, but I do think you've got to hang your hat on Jean-Claude Van Damme. I think he did a lot for that Western style and for the American audiences with his martial arts movies. You get Bloodsport, which literally Enter the Dragon, as Enter the Dragon's bad guy, that is the same movie. And that's kind of like, all right, let's inaugurate this tradition as a Western tradition. And you kind of get that there.
I always thought that Van Damme, his style spoke more to the Sonny Chiba of the Street Fighter, because it was with Van Damme that you start to see all the really hard, like, and you start to see these, which are inspired by the ninja films of the 80s as well, that all of these kinds of little movements that people, like, here's a steeple and here's a church and here's a ninja and all of this stuff, right, with his hands. But it's like an amalgamation of the Sonny Chiba hard style. You know, the debate in the Street Fighter is, can we have a synthesis of Chinese and Japanese fighting styles there? That will be superlative. Rather than Bruce Lee, but there's less flow to Van Damme and more of a, or is that a consequence of the production styles, the editing and the camera work?
Yeah, I would say, well, I always break things up to sound nerdy and official. If you're looking at the pro filmic side versus the aesthetic side, so what's actually happening in front of the camera, the different choreography and the execution of the techniques, and then what's happening behind the camera, how you're shooting it, different camera angles, editing, stuff like that. From the aesthetic side, I think is more what I'm thinking of when I think of Jean-Claude Van Damme continuing that Bruce Lee tradition. But even choreographically, I mean, you have not just the big kicks, you have the flying kicks, you have the jumping in the air. That's some of the things taking those Bruce Lee elements. But most importantly, it is that slow motion, that look at the emotional content, and oh, he throws the punch and he stays and he throws the kick. It's kind of those aesthetic elements that carrying on, like, all right, here, see that in Enter the Dragon, that big slow motion kick, but then he does the big flying kick. Let's do that.
Yeah, that's true. I was just remembering the passion, the emotion that Van Damme will try to put on his face when he's doing especially when he's doing the Dim Mak.
Yes. Yeah. I see the register of that Bruce Lee tradition. I think it's beyond imitation to your question. It's not just like, oh, here's a guy who's, we're going to spell his name like Bruce Lee and he's going to do Bruce Lee stuff. It's more of a, okay, this is baked into the product now. This is part of the tradition, but this guy is doing it original, but you can see the connections, but it's this guy's own thing. It's like, okay, this is a part of the tradition now.
Okay. And I mean, so how, when you came to Cardiff, you initially proposed to do a PhD on the sort of American martial arts film tradition, because the sense was that you wanted to kind of redeem it from the category of not as good as the Hong Kong tradition. So I got the sense when you never got round to writing that PhD. You got derailed and distracted by some other problematics and other questions. But your initial plan had been to do a chapter on each of those big figures, the really big or Hollywood, they're not necessarily American, but Hollywood produced martial arts actors. What would be your response to a project like that today? Because this was a good few years ago now when you really were going to do that. You never got around to it. But
yeah,
what would be your response to your initial proposal now?
Well, yeah, I have like four or five different ideas of big things that I would like to do. And it's just, I usually end up doing one, or they're just all just sitting there taunting me like, you haven't had time to do this yet. Mm. So yeah, at the time I had a couple of different ideas for, I think this could be a good PhD, but first I had to figure out, all right, what actually goes into a PhD? And yeah, then I ended up going down many different rabbit holes that had nothing to do with martial arts. Hmm. But for the Hollywood side of things, the way that kind of manifested, and I needed to get it out somewhere, was really that first essay of mine in the first issue of Martial Arts Studies, that essay on history in the making, where I was like, all right, I got to talk about this. I have to be on the record with this because I want this to be in the conversation. And that was definitely my perspective, and it still is. I still think those are interesting things to explore. And it's always a good scholarly motivation that there's some kind of injustice has been done. People aren't paying attention to the movies that I like. People aren't thinking about this in the way that I think about them. I have to do something about this. It's like, it's your own weird martial arts hero journey. But that was definitely what I was feeling. Like, it's not to pit it against Bruce Lee, but for someone who is obsessed with Bruce Lee, I love Bruce Lee. I used to watch something, talk about him, great. But then when it comes to, I'm going to produce some scholarship, the Bruce Lee issues or questions, he has his champions. He has smart people thinking about things, and it's nice. He's on the radar. These are conversations that we can have. But how come nobody talks about Stephen Seagal? How come nobody talks about this? That was kind of that initial thought of mine. Mm-hmm. And then as I just started to investigate, it's like, even if you want to have the aesthetic quality debate and say, it's as good as, it's as bad as, I can table that and just say, at the very least, it's at least as interesting as. It's at least as worth studying. There's weird stuff happening. There's an interesting timeline. There are different contributions that have been made to martial arts cinema as a global entity from Hollywood that is completely off the beaten path of Hong Kong. If you're looking at Hong Kong martial arts cinema, even if we want to look at Asian traditions generally, you're not going to see the things that you're going to see in American movies. And if you're not watching them, either because you have some kind of bias or you just don't know they're there to watch, how many people know to go look for James Cagney movies from the 30s and 40s? That's not going to help my martial arts study. Yeah, it is. There's a lot of interesting stuff there. So for me, that was that kind of impact. And then, yeah, the stuff that was happening in the 1930s and 1940s in Hollywood, that has a ton of interesting stuff that feed into specifically the Hollywood action and martial arts aesthetic and tradition. And then going into sort of that mid 20th century period, 40s, 50s, and 60s, there's a lot of interesting stuff happening there. But then cream of the crop, the 80s and the 90s. Yeah, you got your American Ninja and you got some goofy stuff there. But the studying the Steven Seagal stuff, studying the Brandon Lee stuff, studying the Jackie Chan Hollywood stuff, opposed to just the Golden Harvest Hong Kong stuff, studying Jet Li coming over and doing Hollywood films, as opposed to just the Once Upon a Time in China. Whether it's this kind of, I don't want to say elitism, because most people in academia don't care about martial arts cinema, but within the little world of martial arts cinema, there's a kind of, well, Hong Kong martial arts cinema is real. Like, okay, fine, feel that, but don't just throw the American stuff in the garbage. There's actually interesting stuff worth exploring that feeds into and can shed some light on even the Hong Kong stuff. So that was something that I want this in the conversation. I want these films at least at the front of people's minds and part of what they're thinking through when they think of martial arts cinema.
So I know that you don't really identify as someone who commentates on cultural issues so much. You like to commentate on what happens within a specific field. Do you think that the American martial arts movie tradition of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and so on, are there wider reasons and significances of it or for it? I mean, was it a way to try and domesticate something foreign, or was it a way to exoticize or militarize, or what were the kind of cultural dynamics of some of the key moments in American martial arts films? This shady area, isn't it? Action film, martial arts film. It's very hard to say what we're dealing with. But if we're dealing with really precisely expressed martial arts fight choreography, and it's a martial arts film, right? With or without the training montage. Training montage always improves things, of course. But I mean, what do these films, do they speak to anything outside of film, or do they just speak within film?
I won't say that they don't speak to anything outside of film, but I will humbly say that that's not my field and I will not speak authoritatively on it. I'll let other people investigate those things and come up with better answers. But I do see different currents in different people's work. And that's one of the interesting things. Like I said, I usually come in from, like a people person, but from a person's specific perspective. So in martial arts movies, it's always interesting that you can approach things from that author perspective, but usually it's more conducive more interesting and more beneficial to approach it from that star perspective. So when you're looking at martial arts movies, I'll usually look to, and then you can differentiate between, here are Jean-Claude Van Damme movies, here are Steven Seagal movies, here are Chuck Norris movies. It's usually a little more interesting that way. And when you do that, then that's, to me, where you can kind of open up those avenues. So if you look at Jean-Claude Van Damme's movie, if you want to talk about what else is happening, he is the guy to go to when you're looking at different gender issues and different gender dynamics within films generally and martial arts movies specifically. The way that his body is kind of on display really throws everything Laura Mulvey said right out the window, even though a lot of other things do that well before the history of martial arts cinema. But it just throws that right out the window. You're like, okay, what is going on with this male body? What is going on with masculinity here? How is masculinity being displayed here? How is the male body? How is the fighting body? All those different things, that's where you go to Jean-Claude Van Damme. When you go to Chuck Norris, you can see that kind of militarized aesthetic and the militarization of martial arts. You pin him to the Missing in Action films as kind of his biggest and most box office specific successful films.
Yeah.
You've got the Vietnam veteran, you've got the soldier, and he does martial arts. So you kind of get that right there in Chuck Norris, and you see that through his films. With Invasion USA, he's protecting USA, and he does martial arts. The Delta Force, yeah, he's got a motorcycle with rocket launchers on it, and he does martial arts. So you've got that kind of military martial arts connection. And then Steven Seagal is, unique is the best way to say it, but he's just a fascinating guy, and his martial arts films are very different yet again. And he's the one you go to if you're looking at different leftist concerns. Usually when people talk about action movies, and especially if you're reading any kind of scholarship on American action cinema, you're going to see a bajillion references to Republicans and right-wing and Reaganite and all this kind of stuff. And then you see Steven Seagal, like, what the hell is this guy doing here? He's nothing like Sylvester Stallone or Arnold Schwarzenegger. You see a different kind of reason, a different kind of sociopolitical impetus in Steven Seagal's films. And you can talk about a lot of different things politically in Seagal's films. So usually I like to think of it star-based. So what's happening in Jean-Claude Van Damme's films, Chuck Norris's films, Steven Seagal's films? And there's a lot of fascinating stuff to do with martial arts, of course, but also beyond that realm, beyond the cinematic realm, a lot of different sociopolitical and cultural things feeding into their star personas and the films that they made.
So the militarization thing, I mean, it struck me as there were different stages of kind of legitimacy claims there's in Western martial arts films. So there has been often, there still is sometimes a resurgence of a reference to an Oriental master, an Oriental sifu, an Oriental sensei, who the American or Western hero is the best student of, may even defeat, you know. So that's the kind of Orientalist critique that kind of we find a bit boring, because it's like, yeah, all right, well. But because I think it's more about a legitimacy claim, isn't it? It's like, why is Van Damme moving like this? Why is Van Damme fighting like this? Why is Chuck Norris behaving like this? And the mystical mumbo-jumbo version of the Misty Mountains and the Orientalist fantasy about Asia, that gets replaced cinematically and possibly even really in history with the militarization, the special forces expertise. So these fighters, their skills have been forged in either Korea or Vietnam. And that's why they look the way that we see this in all kinds of films. Officer and Gentleman and the action, all kinds of things. And it's what Sylvia Huey Chong calls the Oriental obscene. It's like this terrible harrowing of hell that kind of American masculinity was subjected to in the kind of Asian combat arena. But then what happens next? I mean, what do we still see that now? Well, Seagal never really did that, did he? Seagal.
In Under Siege,
he's a kook.
Yeah. But,
and there's something almost militaristic about that, because he's highly trained. And like Jason Bourne in The Bourne Identity, he's like the ultimate product of the American secret military stuff. Why did Seagal never do it? And you know, what happens? What happens now? Because now it's really Gulf Wars. It's really the kind of it's the Middle East, isn't it? That's the arena for the thinking about American masculinity and American kind of combat prowess.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting sort of connection and sort of different because there is a sense like when you watch Jackie Chan in Police Story. There's never the question of how come he's such a good martial artist. Whether you want to say it's just kind of a knee-jerk, well, he's Asian, so I guess I can understand him learning something somewhere. But then when you're in a specifically American context, that question becomes more relevant. Like, how do you know how to do that? So there's got to be an explanation somewhere. And the military is the easiest explanation and the most plausible explanation, something that is historically documented and verified. Soldiers would learn this stuff in combat. But Steven Seagal, individually, just for the question, he is an interesting case because, as you said, he rarely did that. And either he would explicitly not do it, or he would implicitly leave it like, maybe this is the explanation, maybe it isn't. It'll depend film to film. But it is significant that Seagal's very first film, forget that, his very first shot in his very first film is as a teacher of martial arts. Yeah. So he introduces himself as the character Nico Toscani in Above the Law as Steven Seagal, the martial arts expert. And I'm going to explain to you why I'm so good at this. I did go to Japan. I did study this. And that autobiography kind of informs his film. So then his next film in Hard to Kill, he's explaining something like the same origin story, but it's for his character. In something like Out for Justice, there's no explanation, and it kind of makes no sense. This is just a hard-nosed Brooklyn guy, and he's kind of grown up with, like, mob on one side, cops on the other, and now he's going to get revenge. And yet, he's doing all this Aikido stuff. Like, we're not going to explain this. Just, you know who Steven Seagal is. So it's always interesting, how is the origin story going to be told here in this particular narrative context? Under Siege is, like you said, it's the first time where there isn't that oriental narrative story. There isn't that, well, I was highly trained in this place, highly trained by this guy. It's just, he's a Navy SEAL Superman. So of course he can do everything. Then when you get to Jason Bourne, like you said, that's now we have this big military complex and we're going to train these guys to be able to do everything. That includes hand-to-hand combat, that includes weapons and guns and explosives. What comes now? I have no idea, but I will be very interested to see. One of the things is that I wouldn't be surprised, especially in the next 10 years or so, is you just get a character and like, yeah, he used to be a cage fighter. He used to do MMA stuff. He trained some Brazilian jiu-jitsu. He's fought in Little Smokers for a couple of years. You get something like in Wolverine, the character Wolverine in the first X-Men, the first time you're introduced to Logan, he's in a cage fight in a bar. So it's like, well, yeah, he's got steel and he can have claws, but maybe he knows actually how to throw a punch and throw a kick because he's done some martial arts stuff. Look, he's a cage fighter. That kind of stuff is now going to be perhaps baked into some origin stories. Like, well, yeah, there was a Brazilian jiu-jitsu gym. Yeah, I trained with some friends. We did MMA stuff. Like, all right, now I understand why you can throw punches and kicks.
Right. Okay. The main thing that derailed you from actually writing a PhD about the American martial arts film and Bruce Lee was your turn to philosophy. Was that planned? Was it accidental? I mean, I say that academically, you really do strongly identify with the field of philosophy as much as you do with film studies.
Yeah, within the film studies academic world, there's a little sub-discipline called film philosophy with a hyphen, and that's the field that I'm operating in the most right now. But yeah, that was never planned, and I actually joked with an old professor when I was doing my master's. There's the famous French film critic André Bazin, and he once had a joke about, he considered himself a film critic, and he famously wrote that, I don't really have a head for theory, and yet he was a brilliant theorist. But he just never really got that and didn't really want to think of himself as doing it. And for a number of years, especially once I got into academia and was starting to do different scholarly stuff, I joked with a professor, I stole André Bazin's line. I was like, kind of like him, I don't think I have a head for philosophy. That's not really my thing. That's not what I'm doing. I just do film criticism and theory and leave me alone. And then as I was just thinking through things, as I started reading different things, I'm like, yeah, it isn't my problem. My problem isn't with philosophy. It's just with philosophy that I don't think makes sense and that I don't really like.
Yeah.
But once I started reading different stuff, I was like, okay, I kind of get this now. It's just a useful way to start to think through things that do interest me. So I'll always consider myself a film scholar, but I enjoy the film philosophy stuff because it helps to give me some kind of grounding and some kind of sense of, okay, these are the questions that I want to ask. And here are interesting ways to answer them. Here's what's going to be produced if I go down this route. Here's something that's going to happen if I go down this way. And here's why, valid or invalid, good or bad, better or worse. Philosophy kind of helps me navigate that terrain, but it certainly was not consciously planned. And once I settled on my second PhD option of doing like some kind of Bruce Lee study in between different disciplines, I started reading different stuff, different like cultural study stuff, if we put a disciplinary tag on it. And every time I would come upon an argument, I would think, how do I break this down? Why does this person think this and not that? How do they come to this? What's a way to engage with this, critique it, refute it, revise it, whatever the case may be? And every turn, I would like bump into the wall and be like, this is philosophy. I have to do philosophy if I'm going to answer these questions. So it ultimately just became a, now I need to do this, and it'll set a nice foundation. And then I can refer back to this. This can kind of guide my future thinking. So I was like, all right, that's what this PhD is going to be. Just set me on a little philosophical path, took me very far away from Bruce Lee, and now kind of come back through that experience. Now I can go back to, okay, I'm going to explore this film. I'm going to explore this cinematic tradition. And I have these different philosophical ideas and conversations in the background.
So you did marry your philosophical interests with Bruce Lee, though, didn't you? I mean, ultimately what happened was, I think that you spent so long working out the philosophical basis of everything that there was really no room left to write about films or Bruce Lee at the end. And the chapter that you did write about Bruce Lee, the examiner said, this PhD is now too long, you need to just cut this chapter off. So it was like... martial arts studies PhD that by the end of it had like no martial arts at all in it.
Yeah.
But it enabled you to, I mean, now you happily tackle the question of the philosophical trajectory of Bruce Lee's thought, his action, his deeds. And you've written articles that connect it to an American tradition and also that explore it in terms of Chinese philosophical tradition. So on the one hand, in one article, a one which you tried to provoke me to fight you. It was a very provocative article in which you said, Bruce Lee is essentially an exemplary of an American philosophical tradition that has been devalued and excluded from the university syllabus. And then the next article that you write, more or less at the same time, is a really interesting study of the relationship between Bruce Lee and like Confucianism and some aspect of Taoism. So I think, tell us a little bit about either or both of those works and why did you just go after it? Because like, I'm going to do philosophy with this now, or what was the agenda?
Not that intentional, let's say. I did ultimately in the PhD context, just doing sort of the philosophy of art and the film philosophy thing, ending up doing different things, exploring the works of different people. But for a number of years, I took a class as a master's student on the work of Stanley Cavell, the now late American philosopher. And he was the one who found through the history of philosophy, particularly Western philosophy, this tradition of thinking that he called perfectionism. And I found that interesting. And then he would always quote Ralph Waldo Emerson, the American transcendentalist philosopher. And I started reading him and reading Cavell's articulation of perfectionism, reading Ralph Waldo Emerson's works, reading the works of the Russian-American philosopher Ayn Rand, who was also seen to be very perfectionist to me. As I was reading these, because Bruce Lee is just always hovering in the background of my brain, I would read quotes and be like, that sounds like Bruce. And I read something like, haven't I read this before? And then I'd see like, liberate yourself from classical karate. I was like, did he have a book like this next to him? Like, how do these sound so close? It was really just that kind of accidental observation intuition. And then the real goal for me when it came to those essays, in the first part, writing about Bruce Lee as a perfectionist in the Western lineage, it was just curiosity on my part that when people talk about Bruce Lee, or when they think about Bruce Lee, they immediately go to Asia and specifically China. Mm-hmm. Obviously, makes sense. A good first step. But usually there are no steps after that. And I found that interesting. And if you're looking at people talking about Bruce Lee and Bruce Lee's kind of inherited ideas, inherited philosophical trajectories, different things that he was interested in and that kind of shaped his philosophy of martial arts, shaped the kind of movies that he was making, whatever domain you want to look at, people weren't really talking about the stuff that he was reading and interested in from the Western side of things. So that was really the impetus there, was just to say that this stuff can maybe help shed some light on Bruce that hasn't been shed before. Mm-hmm. And then on the Confucian side of things, that was never planned. That was just a question that was asked of me at our Bruce Lee conference in Cardiff. Aaron Hanjun Magnan Park asked me, how does all this perfectionism stuff you keep talking about connect to China stuff? If it does, is there any kind of Confucian legacy? And I was like, I have no idea. Never studied any of that, but that sounds interesting. So I started reading that and I was like, wow, this kind of stuff, it crosses borders, it crosses times. It's more just an orientation than it is a kind of body of work or doctrine or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So I found it fascinating. I started reading Confucian texts, stuff from Confucius himself, the Analects, things like that, more ancient texts, and then more contemporary and neo-Confucian scholarship. Just reading that, I was like, yeah, this is definitely this kind of stuff. This is definitely the perfectionism stuff. You can combine things that you're seeing with Ralph Waldo Emerson and Ayn Rand. You can see it in ancient Confucian scholars. And that just blew my mind. And I was like, okay, maybe it isn't only the Taoism thing. Maybe it isn't only these couple of Zen Buddhist things that we've gone to. Not to say that that isn't valid, but maybe there are other interesting avenues too. So at the very least, if you want to call it my mild provocation, is maybe there's some other interesting stuff to look at. And if you find this interesting, these are some of the avenues that you can go down. So that's kind of how those two essays came together and my kind of sense of them.
Yeah. So the essay on, I'm just sharing the screen for everyone who's watching this. The essay on Bruce Lee's relationship to, I guess, like Eastern philosophies of various kinds was published in the journal called Global Media in China. And it's called Lessons of the Dragon, Bruce Lee and Perfectionism Between East and West. And then the one which celebrates or explores Bruce Lee as in an American tradition is called, it was published in the journal Martial Arts Studies in the issue 8, Bruce Lee's Martial Legacies. And that's called Bruce Lee and the Perfection of Martial Arts Studies, an exercise in interdisciplinarity. And then if anyone who wants to read the grumpiest of responses in the world, then they read my response, Fighting Over Bruce Lee, which basically like, just stop asking me to talk about these things. Why are you making me talk about these things?
So I had to do it once. Had to get you on record once, just respond to all this garbage, and then we move on.
Well, yeah, that's what I did. I did. You provoked me, I destroyed you, and moved on. Anyway, moving quickly on.
Yeah, destroyed.
Yeah.
Quotes around that.
Well, this is the thing that you said to me a while ago. You said this is always the problem with academic debate versus a real fight. You know, if we have a fight, one person wins, one person loses, and it's simple. In an academic debate, the jury is always out, and we don't even have any agreed who the jury is. But I guess we should finish.
That's one of the things that I enjoy. Sam Harris, the American intellectual, had a nice little quote that I always think of and like to refer to in the martial arts context. That he was on Joe Rogan's podcast, and Sam Harris likes Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He's been doing that for a while. And Joe Rogan was mentioning that he was watching a couple of his debates, and he found it interesting. He's like, it's like watching those old Gracie in Action tapes. Like, you're beating these guys, and they don't really know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then he was like, what's more satisfying, doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or debating? And he immediately said, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Because in a debate, nobody ever taps. And it's one of those interesting things that you don't have that visceral feeling of, okay, my arm is here. Mm-hmm. I don't get to just say, no, you don't have me. That doesn't count. Mm-hmm. Your arm's going to break. And then it's like, all right, there's no arguing anymore. You lost. Got that. with academic debates and intellectual debates, it's a lot more fluid. So it's a very different domain, but still fun.
Yeah. And all academic disciplines, as far as I'm aware, suffer from that. I once got accused by someone's friend on Facebook of being, oh God, a typical leftist. There's a left-wing conspiracy. There's a left-wing conspiracy in academia. And I was like, no, there isn't. And this guy went, no, but they're all left-wing and it's a conspiracy and they're all... And I said, I can't think of one academic who agrees with another academic, like all the way down. There's people could never even agree to try and have a conspiracy. They'd just be like, well, why, on what basis, on what evidence should I go along with your position? But we should finish because it's been a while. And I guess the last question should be, what's next for Kyle Barrowman then in terms of publication, in terms of Bruce Lee, martial arts, what are the plans?
Oh, well, right now, just focusing on teaching and teaching online, especially. That's a nice return to having to do editing software that I haven't done since I was in film school to help teach online film classes. But in terms of research and scholarship, it's more within that realm of film and philosophy, just doing different things with Ayn Rand and objectivism, doing different things with Stanley Cavell and ordinary language philosophy. Those are kind of the domains that I'm exploring right now, but always interesting stuff with martial arts, different publications with different people's work that will be possibly coming down the pipe. So I've always thought of martial arts as kind of the hobby and film as kind of the profession. And it's always fun to combine those two. So still going to be several martial arts related things coming down later.
Okay, that's great. Well, Dr. Kyle Barrowman, thank you very much.
Thank you.